secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler.
His website describes Craig Carruthers as a Renaissance man who is a singer, songwriter, producer, recording engineer, background singer, booking agent, graphic designer, photographer, Tex-Mex connoisseur, left-wing inactivist, and a collector of exquisitely obsolete gadgets. He will appear with Six String Concerts on October 6th. Welcome to Craft, Craig Carruthers.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Doug.
Well, with a list like that, it's always hard to know where to start, but let's go with your music, specifically your latest album, last year's 39 Pink Flamingos. And I'd like to read some of the lyrics. I'm not going to attempt to sing them in any way. Okay. Nobody wants that. So the song starts as she's got 39 pink flamingos in her backyard and an orange polyethylene Buddha on the top of her car. Tattoos of Lennon and Santa and one of Jay-Z. She's not making or breaking the rules. She's just free. But unlike many other songs, it turns a little bit darker at the end. So tell me about this song and its subject.
It's actually not a romance song. It's a song about meeting someone who is just extraordinarily quirky and unusual and just not the kind of person you meet every day. And I think so many songs are about romance and all of its permutations, jealousy and unrequited love and betrayal and lust. That's still like the lifeblood of pop music. But I don't know about you, but I still remember the first time that, other than when I was a little kid, I had a woman friend where there was no romantic quality to that. A woman I met in college who's a physician, we've just been lifelong friends. And this song explores this sort of an amalgam of people from my life. And I think the thing about when you see an actor in a movie playing a murderer or something, you don't drive home thinking, I always knew that George Clooney was really a sketchy character. You understand that it's a role. But with singer-songwriters, people tend to think everything we say is our true story. Mm-hmm. But nobody's life's that interesting. And so I think that over the course of my life as a songwriter, trying to incorporate other people's stories and to be a novelist of sorts, creating songs to try to get to a particular kind of a point. And I would guess that if I was going to try to summarize what the point of this song is, it's about sometimes the people who realize that life is short end up experiencing it more fully than some of the people who feel like they have unlimited time.
So how long did it take you to write this song? I'm always curious about that because some people talk about, well, this sort of burst full formed out of my head because it had this particular thing that I really wanted to express. And sometimes it takes forever. I remember hearing about the recording of She Stopped Loving Him Today took 6 months or something like that, probably waiting for him to sober up. But still, it was this long process. So what was the process for this one?
Yeah, well, and in that case, you're actually talking about two different things. Bobby Braddock, I don't think it took him 6 months to write this song.
No, to record it, yeah.
Right, right. But sometimes songs happen really quickly. I've written complete songs in less than an hour. And when it's that, what it, like you're saying, it bursts forth, it lands on you like a bolt from the blue. But this particular thing, I was actually mulling this over, trying to figure out how to get a handle on this as I was driving up to play Columbus the last time I came up. And so I would say between conception and it being finished, it largely got up on its feet probably in a couple of hours, but it was finished within a week.
Mm-hmm. And the inspiration sounds like Columbus. Just driving to Columbus is so inspirational.
That's absolutely true, but I don't want to be dishonest on your show here. I already knew that I was in the middle of this, and one of the things I do when I drive, sometimes I listen to talk radio, but I tend not to listen to music, and so that can be a good songwriting time for me because I'm by myself with nothing else to do.
Mm-hmm. I have, in a similar way, written many things while driving, especially now that we've got voice-to-text stuff, it's so much easier. And now I haven't had any success with what I've written, but that's nothing to do with the technology.
I'll confess, and hopefully this is like when Toby Keith outed Willie Nelson for smoking pot all the time, and then the next day Willie got busted. I hope this doesn't lead to that the next time I'm driving. But if I'm in Wyoming or Montana or someplace where there's just no traffic and you're going for days, I'll have a recorder and a little guitar in the front seat, and I will do lots of stuff while I'm driving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, I actually, when I first started guitar, tried to do things like that as well, and my wife put a very fast stop to it.
Well, you can't do it if you have somebody else in the car.
Yeah,
if you're the driver, they're not going to like that.
Yeah. Even hearing about it, you know, later on, she was no fan of it. So your website also describes you as too folk for rock, too pop for folk, and too jazz for country. So tell me about your musical upbringing and how it led you into this unique territory.
Well, both of my parents were music teachers. And so I was exposed to a lot of different kind of music growing up, jazz and classical music and choral music and vocal groups. And then, of course, like most young people, when I sort of 10, 11, somewhere in there, you start really connecting with songs on the radio and sort of collecting 45s. But I think the thing, and of course, people of my generation tremendously influenced and feel a tremendous amount of affection for the Beatles. But I started writing some songs when I was in high school, and I think largely as a courtship device. But when I got to University of Oregon, it was the first time I heard any Joni Mitchell that wasn't just what was on the radio. And in that period of time, what had been on the radio was like Paved Paradise and You Turn Me On, I'm a Radio. And those songs didn't really appeal to me. And I think I said something disparaging to this other singer-songwriter I met. And actually, I was going to University of Oregon as an English major. I thought I was going to be an English teacher and teach in high school or college. I said something offhandedly dismissive of Joni Mitchell. He says, "Have you really listened to her?" And I said, "Well, I've heard those songs on the radio." And he gave me Blue and For the Roses. And he had both vinyl in his guitar case and in this restaurant in Eugene called Mama's Home Fried Truck Stop when I was going to University of Oregon. He said, "Just take these back to your dorm room and listen to them and then come back and tell me what you think." And people say this all the time, but it really was life-changing. It was a staggering, her unique ability to sing an impossible melody with a really conversational lyric, how incredibly musical she was. It was very moving and very different from what I'd heard on the radio. And it really sort of, I went from being a pretty good student to being a really marginal student because I did sort of doing nothing but writing songs and doing whatever the minimum was to get through my classes.
So if there are any college students listening, this is not the way to go, but it worked really well for you.
It worked okay for me. I have college students here. I teach at the University of Miami. I teach lyric writing and songwriting online. And I often tell them things that is prefaced by, "This is not what the school or your parents want to hear." You can learn a tremendous amount at a university. It is in no way a necessary stepping stone if what you're going to do is have a career as a musical artist.
Right, yeah. I feel like I have to say that because I have a child at a university. And so I got
as well they should be, of course.
Yes, yes.
Do as I say, not as I did.
They do, yeah, yeah. Focus on your studies and not on anything enjoyable. That'll prep you for the rest of your life. When you come to Columbus, what are some of the other songs and things that you've got planned? Do you have set lists worked out ahead of time, or do you wing it with 20 albums under your belt?
I don't know what it is about me. I'm an organized person, but I hate having structure imposed upon me. And so even if I make a set list, it feels like a straitjacket to me. It's never the same as the flow of reading the room. And so there's some new songs I want to play, but they're not available yet, but I want to play them anyway. And then I'll definitely play songs from this record and probably scattered throughout before, but it probably will be a case of there being 40 or 50 candidates that I will draw whatever the number of songs is I play on that evening, mm-hmm. which won't be anywhere near 40 or 50 songs. I know how it works. I've been there several times.
That's a lot to remember. Billy Joel talks about forgetting lyrics on stage and things like that. So that's got to be quite a memory pressure.
Well, I can, of course, shoot myself in the foot by having it end up that I have problems remembering a lyric at the show that we're discussing that hasn't happened yet. But that's really not one of my problems. Okay. For some reason, I could just remember hundreds of songs. I can remember hundreds of jokes. I remember hundreds of phone numbers. I don't think I have a photographic memory, but my memory works very well for me.
As somebody who likes comedy, I have to ask, what's your favorite joke then? What's the one you tell most frequently?
I don't know that there's any joke that I could tell to polite company that I tell frequently. But there are some, I don't even know if it's like that. It's more like if you were a wine expert and you went to someone's house and they served you a dish of something and you'd go, "Oh, that'd go so great with the 72 such and such." Mm-hmm. Something situational will happen and a joke will pop up like a Pez dispenser. Right. Here's the joke for this moment. Mm-hmm. I think one of my favorite jokes I actually heard on NPR where there's two guys and they've been going to baseball games their whole lives. One of them gets wistful one afternoon and they played Little League together and stuff, but now they're in their 60s. And one of them says, "One of these baseball seasons, one of these springs, one of us is not going to be here to play." And he goes, "I don't want to hear it. Let's not talk about that." He says, "No, come on. I've got an idea. If one of us goes first and we're lucky enough to go up, let's make a deal that if it's possible to come back, even for a minute, that we'll find the other guy. We'll come back and we'll tell him about the status of baseball in heaven. The other guy laughs it off. And sadly enough, the guy whose idea it was passes before the next spring. So the guy, sort of a little bit blue about it, a little melancholy, goes to the first game of the season. And he feels a tap on his shoulder, and he remembers, and he sort of shakes it off, and he goes, and then he hears the guy's voice, and he says, "Tom, I've only got a few minutes. I have to tell you, to honor the pact, I have to tell you about the status of baseball in heaven." And he just feels like he's delusional, and he goes, "Okay, tell me about it." And he goes, "All right, well, first of all, everyone who ever played the game is there, and we get to play. Yesterday, Roger Maris and Roberto Clemente were on my team. Tomorrow, I'm supposed to be playing with the Babe. It's incredible." And he goes, "Wow, what else can you tell me?" And he goes, "Well, you're pitching Tuesday."
Nice.
I like that joke because there's nowhere you can't tell it unless somebody just died. And then that's not funny. My uncle just died.
Thank you very much, Greg Carruthers, for talking to me today. We are certainly looking forward to seeing you at Six String Concerts on October 6th. And best of luck driving into Columbus and being inspired again and writing another song.
Thank you very much. And I just have to plug that my good friend and an amazing singer-songwriter, Annie Mosier, will be coming up from Nashville with me to open. She's fantastic.
Excellent.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.
25-year-old Joby Riccio recently released her debut album, Whiplash, which includes songs she wrote as a teenager. Performing them on tour provides a new connection to the songs as well as the audience.
Can I hear and experience this song with these people who are hearing it with a fresh set of ears? And I like to believe an open heart and mind. That's one of the more beautiful experiences about being a songwriter, is how your songs grow and change and how they are different every single night you play them in one way or another.
Riccio shares her growth and change and takes part in the Fast Five on the latest edition of Music Journeys, available as a podcast through the major platforms and WCBE's podcast experience at wcbe.org.
Hi, this is Jim Maneri, the host of 40 by 83. Those are the coordinates in latitude and longitude of Columbus, Ohio, and the name of our show that highlights local music from the Columbus area. There's a wide variety of music that comes out of Columbus, so you might hear anything from the jazz of Hank Marr and Rusty Bryant, to the punk of Earwig and the Molars, the funk of Heatwave, the country of Dwight Yoakam and Kenny Rogers, as well as contemporary pop. Join me every weekday at 7 p.m. for local music on 40 by 83 on WCBE.